Hello, welcome to Radio Gorgeous. My name is Josephine Pembroke. My guest today has put together an anthology of 91 different female writers, and the theme is nature. She is well equipped for the job, having written the acclaimed book, The Fish Ladder. She is Catherine Norbury, and the full title of the book is Women on Nature, an anthology of women's writing in the East Atlantic. Oh, I can never say the last word, archipelago. Can you say that word? Hello, Catherine.
Hello, thank you very much, Josephine, for inviting me. Actually, I think it's 119 voices.
Sorry, 119, that's even
more. Supposed to be 100. Sales love the idea of 100. I refuse to take my 19 out. And so it now says 100 plus on the cover. And I think it's 119. I call it the East Atlantic Archipelago.
Okay. So what is the East Atlantic Archipelago? I can say it now.
Well, technically, I suppose it's the islands of Ireland and Great Britain, the United Kingdom, and the outlying islands. And I think because I'm so uncomfortable with geopolitical boundaries, and certainly in the last few years, just the politics of Europe, politics of Brexit, the rise in nationalism in the different sections of those islands. What I wanted to focus on was the women and their work. And rather than, you know, when one is thinking how to put an anthology together, there are any number of ways of doing it. I could have done it by country, but then where would Cornwall fit in? How would they feel about being part of England? Probably not great. And then there are divisions in the north of the country. So, that was too thorny to pick my way around. And then I thought, well, mountains, beach, forest, and or health, you know, relationships with children in the natural world, gardening, conservation. And I thought and thought and thought about how to do this and thought, well, actually, if it's me, if you give me an anthology, which is a sort of big chunky book, I just wanted to go from A to Z. And so if you want to look up Charlotte Bronte, she's going to be quite near the beginning. And if you want to look at Virginia Woolf, she's going to be quite near the end. And I just felt that was the easiest way of going around it. And so I've actually removed any kind of label, partly also because I think that labelling is a peculiarly male thing in relation to the natural world, taxonomy, knowing the proper name for something. And an enormous amount of energy is expended on social media and in the press about whether it's an arable weed or whether it's an uplands hay meadow or whether it's a wildflower verge. And your ordinary viewer and reader is looking at these conversations and debates and thinking, actually, I haven't got a clue what anybody's talking about, because no one ever bothers to sort of step back and break it down into ordinary language. And I therefore feel, if you like, that one of the problems with nature writing, if you want to call it that, is that it's perceived as a genre, it's perceived in a certain way, and it's largely been shaped by white privileged men.
Yes.
For all kinds of reasons, often very good reasons, because they've had the time and the resources to do it. I think they were walking in a tradition which began in the United States, writers like Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and so it's a tradition of essay writing. It's a certain kind of thing, of which that's not a very articulate word, is it? But it's a thing that conforms, if you like, to a template that isn't necessarily how women approach the world. And so when I started to think about how I might do this, I thought, actually, I'm just going to throw away all the things that join the dots, all the titles, I'll just call it East Atlantic Archipelago because it's a bunch of islands over there and you can go and look it up and you can find out how to pronounce it and what it might be and think what you like of it. And then just invite people to send me work within that framework. So the only limitation on the work was that it is about these islands. You know, who was writing and where they came from. We've got quite a few American writers in this volume. But there is no writing about the United States, it's just here. And again, that was because a lot of the great voices in women's writing about the natural world, Rebecca Solnit, Annie Dillard, Robin Moore Kilmerer, Gretel Ehrlich, are these iconic, big American names, women of enormous substance. And I wanted to take them out as well. So really, it's as though one has a forest and you coppice the trees, you take out the men, that's 50% of the population. You take out everybody who isn't writing in English about the islands of the archipelago, and you just look at what's left. And it was fantastic, actually. Suddenly the sun was sort of shining down onto this forest floor, and all these little shoots were there and had been there all along, but they didn't necessarily fit into the shapes that had been assigned for them.
Well, there was no place for them because it's a mixture of, there's recipes, poems, letters, you know, you've honed it from every different, as you say, it's women's lives, that their lives have been in nature, or they are, you know, so it's they've reflected what's happening, you know, which has been more our role, hasn't it, in the kind of last centuries?
Yes, I think it was the philosopher Timothy Morton who put the beginning of the end, if you like, as the invention of the steam engine. Now that really is comparatively recently. That's when everything began to change. But before that, all our lives were lived in very close connection to the natural world. I don't like the word nature either. I find both women and nature problematic words, which I think is why I just decided to call it women on nature, so that I can get that off my chest.
Right. I'd love to know why before we go further, because that's one of my questions to you, because you say it's you called it an old-fashioned name.
What do you mean by an old-fashioned name?
Well, I think you said that in the preface. You said that it was sort of like it's women on nature. You found it a sort of...
Yes. Yeah. Well, it is almost a little bit archaic, because the words both women and nature have so changed their meaning in the last few years. I think identity politics and the focus on who I am and what my pronouns are and what is a woman, isn't it intensely political, sensitive, spiny, hot subject. And then nature, for me, is it may not be quite as contentious for other people, but the fact that nature, if you like, is generally defined as everything that is not either humankind or made by us. In other words, everything else. That inherently has this anthropocentric position. So it's them and us. It's humans plus everything else. So we're not situating ourselves within it. We're not situating ourselves as part of the whole. So in a way, I'm trying to push against that current trend, which is very important and very relevant and exists for all kinds of extremely good reasons. But I think if what we're going to try and do is engage with the natural world, change the way in which we regard the kind of writing that might be deemed writing about the natural world, we need to situate ourselves within it, not without it. So we're not observing it, we are part of it. And yet the very obvious thing quite rapidly becomes apparent that even if we are a species, just another species, we do have it in our power to absolutely destroy the very fragile planet that we're standing on. I think it was Michael Collins, did he die recently? The astronaut who never landed on the moon, he was the person who circumorbited the moon by himself, waiting while the other astronauts were doing whatever it was that they did on the surface. And I think it was him who, when asked what he thought of Earth when he saw it through space, was that he was struck by how fragile it was. Mm. You know, you imagine this huge, dark, cold, enormous space with this tiny little blue and green planet with the sun coming up and going down and the clouds moving over it. And I often sleep with the radio on, and last night I was listening to the World Service and I was jolted awake with my heart pounding, because it was a business program talking about Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and the race for basically colonizing space and, wow, you know, putting a planet, putting a city on Mars or, and I thought, gosh, you could solve poverty and therefore economic migrants, see. By simply giving everybody in the world a universal basic income of, say, $15,000 a year. You first heard it here. You know, those two men could solve the world's problems.
But instead, they want to be male and have egos and put their mark on history. You know, that's what they want.
This whole tradition of which is, I suppose, is what capitalism is, of going somewhere else and digging it up and taking all the stuff you want from it. And And then when you can't do anything else with it, going somewhere else. And that's what I think we really urgently have to kick against. But ironically, surprisingly perhaps, well, maybe not ironically, this book is not political. A lot of the women who've contributed to it, even women who are conservationists, haven't particularly written about conservation or climate change. They've written whatever they wanted to write. And those things may be, there's a knowledge of those things within it, but they haven't tackled it head on. And I think we need to encourage as much diversity of voice and kind of writing and people who are writing as possible. There was a university, I can't remember which one it is, fortunately, so they can't be cross with me if they hear this, but they have a platform for writing about the natural world, and they were encouraging people to write politically, not to write in a sort of memoir tradition with the eye at the center of it and what I think of it. And they were very encouraging of women and diversity, and they were happy with their first shortlist, which was all women, I think, and many women of color. But I was sort of taken aback by this idea of dictating what one should write. Now, that's not new. It's gone back, you know, there are all sorts of spats in the press between all sorts of largely male writers saying what you can and can't write, and that it must have political content versus the more aesthetic sort of romantic approach to the natural world. And I really think that a writer needs to be able to write what they want to write. And if you want to change the way we live, then just legislate. You know, 10 years ago, people smoked in pubs. What was it, 11 years ago, people smoked in pubs, maybe a bit longer. I remember as a small child coming home from parties with my parents, who probably both had a couple of drinks, asleep on the back seat of the car with no seatbelt. And that was completely normal. Nowadays, we would be horrified. And I think if you want us to drive, this is where Elon Musk comes back into the conversation, electric cars. Most people can't afford electric cars. They cost more than the average income of most people in the United Kingdom, which is one of the wealthiest countries on earth. So you really need to sort of get rid of fossil fuel at a governmental level, worldwide, internationally, and subsidize people to be able to drive what you want them to drive. We can't do it. And so I think shouting at writers and telling us what we ought to do, I find extraordinarily reductive. I think it's something that's come about since the crash, since the sort of 2009-ish, when a lot of industries became much more conservative, including publishing. And so the joy of this anthology, and it was made through a crowdfunding platform, is that...
Why was that?
Well, it was Unbound's idea. They came to me and said, would you be interested in making an anthology about women's rights, you know, women and nature? And I thought, well, yeah, all right. And originally I thought, well, yes, this is probably 6 months' work and I'll just commission 15 essays by 15 women and then that'll be it. And then it'll look like all the other anthologies. And there will be essays if I do that. And then I thought, oh, no. I want to do more than that. I want to look back further. I want to see if actually we can't just unpack the whole thing.
Yeah, tell us how far you go back.
Well, I'm not sure, because of my history, really, it's a bit woolly, whether the first writer would be Marjorie Kemp or Julian of Norwich. They were both contemporaries of one another, both in sort of East Anglia, Norwich area.
Which was a very wealthy place then, wasn't it?
It was a very wealthy place, and that's an interesting observation.
16th century, are we?
No, 14th century.
14th, God.
Yeah, for 700 years. The only reason I'm not sure who came first is because I don't know when Julian of Norwich wrote her Revelations of Divine Love. So I think I vaguely describe them in the book as being, one of them as being the first book written by a woman in English, which is...
I think you said Julian was, actually.
Yeah, I think it is. But Marjorie Kemp is attributed as being the first autobiography in English, although she dictated that because she probably wasn't literate. She probably couldn't read or write, and she dictated it to a scribe. They would have both been quite well off. If you want to be walled and live in poverty in a cell with three windows for the whole of your life, you will need to prove to the church that you've got the wherewithal to do that before they agree to take you on as a burden. So, you know, it's a misnomer often to look at a religious life and think those people live humbly and are poor. You had to be quite well off in order to live the religious life.
Yeah, to buy your way in, as usual.
Yeah, you did. It's like a poker game. So I started with them and really just found this description of a storm at sea that Marjorie Kemp had decided she wanted to go and visit her daughter-in-law in Danzig without really knowing where it was, and hired a ship and sailed off, and they got caught in a terrible storm and she hadn't got any of the right clothes and they ended up being blown to Norway. And I thought, well, my goodness, if that isn't a relationship with the elements, I don't know what is. And then Julian of Norwich had a really interesting theology. She's still Julian of Norwich. She's not Saint Julian for reasons unknown. She was never picked up by the Catholic Church, perhaps because of the unorthodoxy of her views. But she saw the divinity or the divine as either without gender or having both. I think she talks about the relationship between Christ and the church as like a mother and a child. And she had a I don't know what she felt and saw, but she seems to perceive life and divinity in everything, which is really helpful if what you're trying to do is persuade people to conserve the planet. And I do think that that's an area of, in the great debate about whether you should have a scientific-based, conservation-based political angle to your writing, or whether you should celebrate the beauty of the natural world. I think the third great way of looking at things, which is the spiritual path, has simply not been picked up.
Yeah.
And the Greek Orthodox Church have been really good at this. They've been doing it for years. The Catholic Church, I think, Laudato Si on Care of Our Common Home, written by the current Pope, was at the encyclical, was 2015, I think, which got him a standing ovation at the Paris Climate
Call. Very good.
And I can't remember quite when this was, but UK environmentalists were asked in a government survey what were the 50 things that they thought would really save the planet. And I think number two was persuade world religious leaders to support the cause.
The thing that I don't understand is we are nature. What are we made of? We're made of the earth. You know, we are all part of it. And the spiritual quest that you're saying is, well, nature is spirit. You know what I mean? It's just literally a change of consciousness, isn't it, for people?
It is. And the sooner we sink into it and realise that we are part of this, and that our connection... And that's why I am a huge supporter of allowing writers to write whatever they want, because they want to write about how you stand on the earth and you feel energy coming up through the soles of your feet. You don't have to justify that in what you learned in your physics lesson. I think it's really important that we enable ourselves to feel that organic connection that cats and dogs and birds and bats, all, we're perfectly happy for them to have that.
Yeah, they knew when the tsunami was coming. They know when the storm's coming. You know, they're in tune.
Well, you know, if only we could find out the story of this little minke whale who sailed up the Thames last week, tragically, and beached at Richmond, which is an appalling story. This little calf, goodness knows how it became separated from its family, but there's so much noise out there on the seabeds, mining, drilling. You know, whales use echolocation over vast distances to keep themselves together. There's so much poison and pollution in the sea. The sooner we start seeing ourselves as one of these incredibly sophisticated species, that will also die out. And really, I don't want to go and live on Mars in a
God, no.
It wasn't what Damon was doing.
In a bubble, it'd be locked down all the time.
Yeah, using my own feces to sort of, you know,
plant something.
And, or my friends. I don't see that as an improvement.
No, nightmare.
You said, if we are to survive as a species, it's going to be in space. Mm. Why does it have to be in space? I wish we could, in a way, it's like that idea of eternal life. You know, if we could just focus on the life we've got and look at it, love it and celebrate it and live it. And so that is what has driven me, if you like, to open the gates and create this enormous book, which has got all kinds of different perspectives of how we interact with the with the natural world. I suppose I'm trying to broaden the definition of nature, if you like, to both include us, but also to situate our terrifying position of responsibility within it. But if we don't, you know, sort of step up to the plate soon, it will be too late.
Do you think we have a more spiritual connection as women to the earth than men do naturally?
I don't know. I'm really wary of
labeling again.
Yeah, again, of making broad.
But if you think about the name Mother Earth.
Well, again, I suppose I struggled with that. One of the reasons I called the book Women and Nature, Women on Nature, was because of a book published in 1978 called Women and Nature by Susan Gittins, who was a quite controversial feminist, who wrote a sort of polemic, really, which was, it was called, the subtitle was The Roaring Inside Her. And it was this rage against the patriarchy of putting, you know, Mother Earth, Father Sky, male men as...
Even naming them, yeah.
Adam and Eve, the whole idea that we're somehow in tune and better at these spiritual things.
I suppose the thing is what they're thinking. A man is thinking that the woman come, they're born from a woman, so maybe the woman does have more of a connection with, you know, nature than they do. They don't maybe feel as connected because they are not. We're the producers, if you know what I mean. We are the ones.
We are the producers, but you know how many assassins within paramilitary organisations are women?
I don't know how many.
I mean, a poem that was almost in here was that I ended up not including in the end because I couldn't clear it quickly. Was a poem by Colette Bryce in memoriam of Jean McConville, who was murdered by the IRA.
Yes.
10 children taken over the border, believed to have been an informer, and executed. Well, she was taken over the border by 3 people, 2 of whom were women. We don't know who the 3rd one is because I believe they're still alive, and so that name hasn't been divulged. But she was driven over the border and executed, possibly by a posse of women, certainly by 2 women. And I wanted to include that story because, of course, she was buried, and then the IRA said they didn't know where she was, and it turned out that the man who disposed of the disappeared bodies had Alzheimer's and couldn't remember, and it was this, you know, Bailey fiasco. And then there was a storm and part of the cliff came away, and suddenly her body was revealed on the beach years and years after he'd gone. And I just thought, you know, the idea of those dog walkers walking on a Sunday afternoon, somebody must have written about that. And I found a woman who had written about that and didn't in the end include it just because I couldn't follow the trail of the permissions, which is another thing when you're making an anthology, you have to track that.
What happens then if you can you put so why can't you put something in because you can't get permission or
sometimes it's just if there are electronic portals, and we had a very limited budget because it was a crowdfunded project, so we could offer an honorarium but we couldn't do a sort of amount per word, and you can't do that, you can't have that conversation with an electronic portal. You just sort of put in what you want and then it tells you, you know, either yes or no, and we'll get back to you when we've got an answer, and this is how much it's going to cost. And some of that just proved too complicated to pursue.
So I know it's a very corny question, but who is the most moving writer in the book for you? I mean, with the story that really goes through your mind a lot, you know, that you read.
Ooh, well, there are so many of them, and they are so very different, and so diverse in their voices, that I would find it really difficult to separate them. One of the voices who I came across, because her granddaughter, Jane Wellesley, brought the book to me, is a writer called Dorothy Wellesley, who was the Duchess of Wellington. She was writing the first part, beginning of the last century, and all her work has gone out of print. And she's fantastic. W.B. Yeats enormously admired her work. I mean, she was friends with Vita Sackville-West, and I don't know if she was a friend or a rival of Virginia Woolf, but she was part of that group of writers, and she's just disappeared without trace, but her writing is exquisite. And you know, somebody out there must please pick up the writings of Dorothy Wellesley and republish them. I think they're beautiful. We've got women like, oh, we've got Alice Oswald again. It's superb. I've got the lovely Jackie Kay, who I so admire. One of the voices that I really enjoy is Dorothy Pilley. There's a lot of Dorothys. We have called Dorothy in this book, who was a mountaineer, again, middle of the last century. She wrote a book called Climbing Days. And again, her great-great-nephew, Dan Richards, who himself wrote a book called Climbing Days, in which he followed in Dorothy's footsteps, gave me this. And these books are all out of print, so I've had to type them all out myself. So I really hope that it's probably more typos than there should be, if you ask a dyspraxic person to also be the copy typer. And she was a mountaineer, and oh, it's just that extraordinary comfort in her own voice and authority of, you know, learning to climb in the Welsh mountains and then going over to Switzerland and just striding out. And
it's brilliant. Again, you're giving these women who a voice, who are literally being, they're not in history because, you know, they haven't been acknowledged or whatever. And it's fantastic.
I'll tell you who I do love. Margaret Cavendish, who was, she was the Duchess of somewhere, Northumberland, I think. Mm-hmm. Some of these women have so many titles that I haven't got any titles in the body of the work. It's just a fact that because if you had money then and privilege, then
well, you could read and write, basically.
So up until the last third of the last century, most of those women enjoyed some degree of privilege. But Margaret Cavendish wrote this brilliant dialogue between an oak tree and a man who was felling him. In which the oak tree is arguing for his life,
and the man is saying,
and it's a really lovely discourse. I think because somebody, someone like the king had said to Margaret, "I want all your trees because we need to build warships," and of course these trees, an oak tree can live 1,000 years, and she didn't want it to go. So that I found really poignant. She was, I think, an enormous star of her day. I think she was the first female member of the Royal Society, which is
lastly, why is Woman on Nature an important book, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure. I did think particularly, I mean, everyone's telling me it's an important book. I wouldn't have thought of it in that way. I think it's important because it does bring together women. Certainly, I mean, those people I've talked about are all historical characters. Half the women in the book are writing now or are still alive. Some of them may be very old, some of them are very contemporary. And so you start to see that change of voice of all the different kinds of women that are writing, the subjects that they're writing about, the nationalities. There are women, Naoko Abe writes beautifully. She's a Japanese writer writing about English cherry trees. Ginny Reddy is a great travel writer in the good old-fashioned tradition that, although now she's moving into more of what we might call nature writing, there's a piece in here that she wrote about 5 or 6 years ago about the stars in Northumberland, which are absolutely gorgeous. And so I think it's important because it does have, I've got children in here. That's, you know, two of the contributors, I think, were about five, which was Gertrude Bell, who grew up to become a very important colonial ruler in, you know, what mm-hmm. is now Iraq. I don't know, I've just forgotten how to pronounce it. Bacchanalty. Forgive me, I have forgotten how to pronounce it.
Okay. I was going to ask you to read a poem because there are poems in there as well. I mean, what's great about this book is, I know this sounds a bit rude, you could have it in the loo, you could have it by your bed, you could have it, because, you know, it's literally, some things are 2 pages, some things are 4 pages, some things, so it's really lovely to dip in and out of, you know, just for inspiration. Instead of having a meditation, you could read one of these uplifting nature stories.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the loo, because I'm hoping it will be in every downstairs loo of every house in the country, and by the spare bed, because that's where a good anthology should be.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to read you a poem by Jane Lovell called Vixen, which was actually published last year in a collection. And I included it because it actually echoes Naoko Abe writes about the cherry trees of England, the cherry trees of Japan that were saved in England and exported back to Japan. And this just seemed to complement those cherry blossoms. And yeah, so Vixen. And there, through this Japanese ghost garden, this monochrome dreamscape slips a half-dreamt wraith. Born from the last shades of dusk, she is tip-tip-toeing on footfall so soft it uncurls snails, dizzies galaxies in dew. Her vagabond heart beats with the tremors of the earth, balances on owl call and the breeze rushing the trees. Behind her swim timorous worlds we can never enter. So slight and swift she moves, that without the moon billowing through the cherry and all the fallen blossom, luminous as snow, I would not see her.
Lovely. And I like the way, I know I'm being sexist, but I do like the way it's a vixen.
Well, I think, yes, there was probably reason in my choosing that.
Fantastic. So people can go out and buy it now, can't they? It came out yesterday. It's called Women, yes. Women on Nature, edited by Catherine Norbury and published by Unbound Books. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous again.
Thank you so much, Josephine. It's been a real treat to be here and a huge privilege. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.